You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, October 21st, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, an update on the Affordable Care Act. Not terribly healthy at this moment. However, not as bad as some at Fox would lead you to believe. Also on the program, even more new revelations from the NSA spying. And the latest data out of Iraq. I know we don't talk about that anymore. The U.S.-led invasion and occupation, illegal invasion and occupation of Iraq, has led to nearly 500,000 deaths in that country. Also on the program today, what's next in the wake of the shutdown? Really, the ongoing shutdown of the U.S. government, as we still living in an age of austerity, costing millions of people their jobs and their financial security. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Of course, later in the program, we'll take your phone calls, 646-257-3920. We will take your IMs, as we are wont to do. Just one more way in which you can be part of the program. Let's start with some good news for today. In New Jersey on Friday, the New Jersey Supreme Court decided to allow gay couples to begin marrying today on Monday. Or I should say the marriages begin today on Monday. Some may have already taken place. While it considers an appeal of a ruling allowing gay nuptials. Governor Chris Christie, the moderate, believes that, is appealing a lower court ruling. The issues will be decided in 2014. The court's ruling surprised some and left a lot of couples who were preparing for their marriage or had their marriage on hold scrambling around on Sunday to prepare for their upcoming nuptials. The two plaintiffs in the original case, Marcia Shapiro and Louise Walpin, have been married already early this morning after 12 midnight at a state representative's New Jersey home.
Cory Booker married a few couples this morning at midnight.
And I believe he also married some straight couples. He had refused to marry any couples at all until gay marriage was allowed in the state.
And Christie dropped his appeal this morning.
Oh, he did?
Yeah.
So there you have it, folks. That's a done deal. Not terribly surprising. If you had several months of gay marriages, it would have made it that much more difficult for a court to reverse this.
He said something like he was disappointed with the opinion, but he will uphold the law as stated by the New Jersey Supreme Court.
Yes. Ah,
so he's only moderately discriminatory.
Exactly. Just waiting for that 2016 run. I just want to read this quote from Miss Walpin, who is now Mrs. Walpin, I guess. She said, here we were shopping in a mainstream mall, and we were telling every single salesperson that we were getting married. She's 60 years old, and she said it was the first time in 24 years together that we could be saying who we are and have people really validate our relationship for us. It really is stunning. I was at a friend's house last night in Brooklyn, and in the backyard, they had one of those apartments that had a garden. And in the backyard, it was adjacent to another townhouse that had a garden. And there was a door in between the two gardens. And apparently both homes were owned by a gay couple, a lesbian couple, years ago. And the only way they could sort of maintain cohabitation was through that gate in their backyard. It just gives you a sense of just how far society has progressed. Obviously not quick enough, but it's nice that we can live in an age where people don't have to hide in the shadows. So congratulations to those folks. And Chris Christie has managed to sort of put this behind him well in advance of the 2016 election. So good for him. He can just go on attacking unions and teachers and see how that does for him. And speaking of attacking teachers, I teased this last week. I want to read it. I don't have much to say beyond this. And in the coming weeks, now that we're out of sort of the crisis mode with our with the Republicans holding our government hostage, we can move on to other topics, not the least of which is the ongoing assault on our schools by the corporate reform movement, which shows itself in many different ways, and not the least of which is this high-stakes testing regime. We have spoken many times of the implications of the high-stakes testing. It is an all-out assault on allowing educators doing what they know how to do best, which is to educate children. It is, and it's an all-out assault on our children in many respects. Not only does it pervert their education, because when you tie in the assessment of where students are in their learning, when you make that an absolute measure of the quality of teachers, and you encourage schools to become nothing more than little mills teaching to the test because it's the only way these schools can survive, it begins to impact the students in ways that I think people do not contemplate. There was a post by Allie Gordon. I'm not sure what the what blog it came from. She was a parent. She wrote a letter to the Board of Regents and her state representative in New York. I'm not going to read the entire letter, but I'll read parts of it. She says how this fight against high-stakes teaching became very personal. She writes, my 10-year-old daughter asked me what it would take for me to let her stay home from school forever. Isabella is very well-spoken, very bright. She describes herself as a feminist and loves to debate adults about the inequality of women's pay for equal work. She's committed to calling out bullies in school and helping those she sees that need a little boost. She can carry on conversations about interesting points and people in American history most kids have never heard of. However, Bella doesn't learn some things as quickly as other kids do. She struggles with reading at grade level and has difficulty memorizing math facts. Math word problems are confusing for her and takes her longer than her peers. She has to work really hard to be successful academically, and she does work very hard. But tonight, Isabella decided that she has had enough. School is too hard now, she said. I'm too stupid to do this math. I can assure you we don't use the word stupid in our home to describe anything, especially not people. But in the one-hour conversation we had in which she was begging me to let her quit school, Isabella used that word stupid to describe how she felt about herself more than 10 times. The mother writes, because when a child is broken in spirit, when they have lost their self-worth and confidence, that damage is not erased easily. When children hate school to the point that they attempt to avoid it at all costs, there will be no desire to be college or career ready. Now, before you say, I just want my child to succeed no matter what, and must be one of those everyone gets a trophy for participating parents, let me say this. I want my child to be challenged. I want them to have to work to be successful. I want them to sweat it out occasionally and have to ask questions to clarify. I want their curiosity to lead them down paths I never imagined. But when they have no confidence, they will not try. They will not raise their hand to ask a question. They will fear homework, quizzes, and exams. And the voice they hear in their heads telling them they can't will create a self-fulfilling prophecy. So they won't succeed. If these insane policies pushing developmentally inappropriate curriculum on our children are allowed to stay in place, what will the future hold for those students who do not fit this one-size-fits-all approach? And she's talking here about the core curriculum, the Common Core curriculum, which is in and of itself problematic because it's the Common Core curriculum. And it is forcing teachers to put in many cases, I mean, we talked about the story last week about kindergartners being forced to take standardized tests when many of them don't even know the basic skills on how to use a pencil. And there are some kids, obviously, who have progressed further and other kids who have not. And that's why you want a teacher in the room to determine what is appropriate for the class. But if they are forced to teach a one-size-fits-all test because they are getting pressure from their administrators, because their administrators are getting pressure from their school boards, because this is the only way to keep schools open, this is what you get. You get many children left behind. What will happen when the precious data doesn't show the growth of these education reformers want to see because so many kids just give up? How many kids have to be hurt before we stop? How many kids have to use that word to describe themselves before we realize the damage that is being done? She continues writing, tomorrow morning I will bring Isabella to school. I will tell her that I know this is hard, but she has to just try her best. I will tell her I know how smart she is, and so does her teachers. I will kiss her head, and I will whisper, I love you, with a smile. After she walks down the long school hallway, I will use every ounce of passion and compassion I have to call on my elected representatives to stop the abuse. I will contact every media outlet and offer my story, Isabella's story. I will call, write, tweet, and email the Board of Regents and the New York School Education Commissioner, and I will request meetings with policymakers. I will rally friends and family to do the same. I will not sit back and wait for someone else to get this done. No one has the right to implement policies that are downright abusive, no matter how lofty their goals. This is to say nothing of the rampant profiteering that is taking place in this school reform movement. Nothing of its agenda to simply break the backs of teachers' unions. This gets down to just what is just horrible education policies that are being foisted upon children and teachers to fit some type of political ideology that is born out of a corporate mentality that has no place getting between a teacher and their students. And, you know, this is an incredibly difficult fight because it's very hard to push back against an agenda that is at its very nature designed to succeed in the marketplace. When you're talking about the corporate reform movement of schools, you are talking about it being staffed and funded by people whose primary professional life has been developing things to be sold on the side of a package or a billboard or in a 30-second ad. And they are attacking people whose entire professional training and motivation and experience is designed to be fundamentally far more nuanced and not to reach a mass group of people, but to function on a level of individual students. And so it becomes very hard for them to push back, frankly, because there is no one-size-fits-all answer for this. The only thing we know in terms of a glib response is that if you look at the median income of people living in a district, and not just the ones who are willing to go down and put their names in a lottery and be self-selected because they have the opportunity or the will, or they've been able to manage, or they have enough breaks, or they have enough family to take care of the kid so that they can get involved in their schools. If you look at the median income in any given school district, it is almost with virtual certainty that you can predict the quality of the school. That's the only thing that you can say that is in any way glib or able to be digested in the small amount of time that people have to make this argument. And so this is going to be, you know, this is an ongoing fight. And I don't know where it ends, frankly. Because as soon as you start to allow the profiteering that takes place in this corporate school reform movement, then, you know, you just have that much more of an incentive structure that makes it harder to stem this tide. But I want to turn now to what's happening in the wake of the government shutdown. And much of it can be encapsulated in this segment with Dick Durbin on Fox Sunday. One thing you should know off the bat, Dick Durbin... And past performance is no guarantee of future performance or current performance. But Dick Durbin has often been President Obama's guy in the Senate to carry unpalatable things to the progressives that remain in the Democratic Party. And so here he is on Fox News Sunday with Chris Wallace, and we're going to play this extended clip, but I will stop it as we go. Let's play this clip.
Very spending. Well, let me pick up on that with you, Senator Durbin, because as Senator Blunt suggested, Republicans have some leverage here. If nothing happens, the sequester spending cuts kick in on January 15th, and discretionary spending is cut by $21 billion. Paul Ryan, the House budget chair, is proposing a kind of trade in which they would agree to some short-term spending increases, which you guys want, in return for some long-term spending cuts through entitlement reform.
Okay, pause it right here. All right, first off, Chris Wallace is setting the table in a way that is inaccurate. Because, yes, it is the case that Democrats in particular have real problems with what's happening with the sequester, because we have so many cuts in discretionary spending that has fallen on the non-military side. But one thing that Chris Wallace does not say here, and Dick Durbin should have made clear, is that coming in 2014, there will be $21 billion of additional discretionary spending cuts, but $20 billion of that will fall on defense spending. Now, those who made the mistake of believing the sequester would force everybody to the table the specter of the sequester back in the 2011 budget deal would force Republicans to the sequester. The super committee would do its job. And many of those people were also hoping that we would get cuts to Social Security at that time. We're wrong. They underestimated the Republicans' loathing of any new revenues in terms of taxes, which makes the fiscal cliff deal that took place at the beginning of that year that much more ridiculous. Well, I should say, I guess it was in 2012, that much more ridiculous because that's where the leverage was. That was going to happen automatically. Nevertheless, the reality is going into these sequester talks, there are a lot of Republicans in the Senate. John McCain, Lindsey Graham, who are very concerned about the defense cuts. Me, not so much. However, understand that what we have been living under, and David Dayan has a great piece out, I think it's in Salon, that we have been living under a partial government shutdown in terms of its implications for our economy. Standard and Poor estimated that the shutdown cost the economy $24 billion over 16 days. Sequestration, if it's in place for the 10 years as contemplated, and as law at this point has, but remember, future Congresses are not held to the laws that past Congress has made. In 2014, if there's a Democratic Congress and they want to come in and reverse those sequester cuts, they can do it. But over the course of 10 years, it would be $1.2 trillion, 50 times the economic impact of the shutdown, which doesn't include the knock-on effects, as David Dayan writes, to reduce purchasing power by federal employees and fewer contracts for private companies doing business with the government. If kept in place through the 2014 fiscal year, sequestration will have cost up to 1.6 million jobs in this economy, shaving nearly a point off of the GDP. On top of that, we're already living under other budget cuts. We are living in an age of austerity right now. But the reality is going to be that we can't do anything about it for those who want to. Continue.
Does that sound reasonable?
Well, I can tell you this. If this is the bargain that the Republicans are now pushing for, that we have to cut Medicare to avoid cuts in the Department of Defense, they ought to step back and take a look at this. Paul Ryan couldn't pass his budget in the House of Representatives. The Republican majority wouldn't vote for it unless he violated the Budget Control Act and added more than $20 billion in defense spending. We ought to sit down together and realize that sequester is the clumsiest, most awkward, ham-handed way to cut spending. We can do it much more sensibly. And I think we can meet our...
And here is the other big problem here. Now, Durbin addresses that trade-off. I mean, it's sort of obtuse the way that they're presenting this. But he's basically saying, I know that $20 billion of those cuts that are going to come in sequester are defense spending. You're not going to get a deal from us to cut Medicare and theoretically Social Security, so that you can add more money to defense spending. And then Durbin goes on, and he still is embracing this austerity line that came out of the White House in 2011, in 2010. There's still, the Democrats in the Senate still cannot get enough of a spine to simply say to the American public, hey, you know, this is destroying our economy. Austerity has failed in Europe, and it's failing here. And our budget deficit has dropped at a rate that we haven't seen in 70 years. And this is no time for this. This is where that conversation should end, instead of this notion of we can come up with better sequester cuts. The bottom line is, if you cut $10 billion in a stupid way or a so-called smart way, it's still $10 billion less of government spending. It is still going to have the same impact on our economy. It doesn't matter. Continue.
spending targets, we can reduce the impact, the negative impact of sequester on our national security and national defense.
Well, then let me ask you, you know, and don't get into the weeds on me here. If they were willing to relax some of the short-term spending cuts for defense and domestic programs, what would you give them?
Well, I'm going to leave that to Senator Patty Murray. I'm not going to negotiate here on Fox. Patty Murray is the chair of our budget committee. I respect Paul Ryan. We disagree on politics and certainly on issues like the future of Medicare. But when it comes down to it, we've got to be able to put everything on the table. That means Republicans have to be willing to put revenue on the table. I just can't understand this basic premise that this tax code is sacred, that there aren't loopholes in there that should be closed and the savings be dedicated to reducing the deficit. Why is that such a radical idea to most Republicans?
All right, pause it here. Now, despite the calls from Ezra Klein and Ruth Marcus now in the Washington Post, this is the only way. What Durbin is doing here is purely defensive. And the Democrats know that the Republicans are loath to raise any taxes or to close any tax loopholes. And this is essentially what the game plan has to be. And that is no deal. Maybe we can nibble on the edges on some things, but this is the only way that the Democrats can seem to find that in themselves to protect Social Security and Medicare by putting a poison pill into these negotiations. But it's extremely dangerous because just as we have seen now the impact of the rhetorical agreement by Democrats about austerity is coming back to bite everybody in the ass, so too may this continue.
Talk about Obamacare in a second, but you're not answering my question. Why do taxes have to be on the table? Why can't you just make a deal, short-term spending for long-term entitlement reform, which, Senator, you support and President Obama supports? You have supported the idea of some entitlement reform.
That's right. I do. And I'll tell you why. Because Social Security is going to run out of money in 20 years. I want to fix it now.
Stop it. Now, I don't know why or what message person in the Democratic brain trust feels that it's okay to continue to foist that lie on the American public. But that is categorically, unequivocally false. In 20 years, based on fairly conservative estimates, if we do absolutely nothing, Social Security will pay out 78% of its benefits going forward on what in budgetary parlance is an infinite horizon. So it will not be broke in 20 years. It will not be broke in 20 years. In 20 years, if we do nothing, like, and by nothing, I mean, don't raise the cap on Social Security taxes so that the traditional amount of U.S. income is subject to those taxes. If we do not remove the cap of Social Security taxes, so that millionaires and billionaires can start paying an equal percentage of their income as would a bus driver, then we will see 22% cuts to Social Security. So the idea of cutting a little bit now, and this is also the lie about the change CPI, it won't change that calculus very much. It won't change that calculus very much at all. Maybe it'll shave 4-6 percentage points off that. So we'll get 18% of our promise, or 18% less of our promise benefits, which simply sets it up for the next round of, we got to cut Social Security more to save it. Continue.
Before we reach that cliff, Medicare may run out of money in 10 years. Let's fix it now. And that means addressing the skyrocketing costs of health care. That's what Obamacare is focused on. And yet the Republicans want nothing to do with it. If we don't focus on health care and on dealing with the entitlements, the baby boom generation is going to blow away our future. We don't want to see that happen. We want to make sure that Social Security and Medicare are solid.
All right.
There's a really easy way to make Medicare more solid. And that is to bring everyone into the program. And if you want to bring down medical costs, having an expanded risk pool of people who are not as risky as 65-year-olds. And having a single-payer system wherein they will have access to data all around the country, wherein experts can make the determination, hey, you know what? CAT scans for a groin pull isn't necessary. We're not going to pay out benefits for that. They can begin to bring down the costs of delivering medicine. Because we know the problem is not with Medicare. It is far more efficient and remains even now. Even with the Affordable Care Act's restrictions on how much insurance companies can spend and charge relative to the amount of medical care that is actually paid for. Even under the Affordable Care Act, we know that 20 cents on every dollar, at least in theory, 20 cents on every dollar still goes to things like advertising and shareholder benefits and CEO bonuses. Whereas in Medicare, this number is around 3%. So none of the stuff that Dick Durbin is talking about, even though he may get to a place which would protect Social Security and Medicare in the short term, none of the rhetoric is furthering the or really dealing with the real problems here. Now, I get it. It's on Fox. You're talking to the rubes. But honestly, why not have a conversation with the American public and begin to change the rhetoric so that we can fight these battles down the road? Or is it maybe they just don't believe in it? I don't know. But if we get more of this mealy mush from supposed liberal champions like Dick Durbin, it's not one of those, future looks so bright, I got to wear shades type of scenarios. I don't know how else to put that. And just a couple more pieces on the wake of this shutdown. Politico has a good rundown of the shutdown, and it edifies some of the stuff that I have been hearing and have been talking about over the past couple of days, that really the linchpin in preventing the Republicans from getting the grand bargain, from using this debt ceiling and government shutdown as an effective hostage situation, the guy who stood between that and the administration's long settled, and you can tweet at me, the Obama bots can fire up their machines and tweet at me right now, their long settled desire with the administration to make a deal to reform entitlements, i.e. cut Social Security. The guy who stood in between the Republicans and the Democrats on that was Harry Reid. A couple of choice quotes from this political piece. Apparently Obama was outside one of the meetings with John Boehner as he had to go get on a cigarette break and presumably take a shot. John, what happened? Obama asked, according to people briefed on the October 2 conversation. I got overrun. That's what happened, said Boehner. I wonder what President Obama said at that point. Like, man, you're useless. Why are you here?
And then Boehner said, it's your fault.
It's your fault.
For being black and being president. What the hell?
You couldn't have changed your middle name. Republicans cycled through every option possible during the three-week standoff to save face. Their Obamacare demands devolved from a repeal and defund to a delay of the individual mandate. They revived the idea of a grand bargain on taxes and government spending, but Reid openly laughed when Boehner raised it during a White House meeting. They offered a more narrow proposal to replace the sequester cuts for 2 years. Then they went back to Obamacare, and nothing worked. And here is the piece that confirms what we know about the last fiscal cliff negotiations. When things were at their worst, some Republican senators urged Vice President Joe Biden to get more involved. But he told each of them it wasn't his call. Biden participated in meetings at the White House, but Reid, still angry about the vice president's concessions during the fiscal cliff talks last December, had shut him out of direct negotiations with lawmakers this time around. We know that Biden stepped in and let the Republicans off the hook when the Democrats had all the leverage. Again, I remind you, the Bush tax cuts were going to sunset at January 1, 2012. 2013, excuse me. If the entire House and Senate went on an extended carnival cruise and didn't return until January 2nd, they would have in their pocket, the Democrats, taxes raised on everyone across the board back to Clinton administration levels. And then they would have been in the driver's seat and said to the Republicans, here's your opportunity to vote against the middle class tax cut because we're not giving it to millionaires and billionaires. Why didn't they do it? Because the White House didn't want that type of leverage. They didn't want to go into this fistfight with a 300-pound gorilla. Or with just a gun, or even a knife. Because that would be rude. And one last note. Dave Weigel, who understands the Republican caucus as well as anybody, I believe, and who's willing to really lay it out, takes issue with all the stories. And this came up, I think, a week or two when I was on Hayes' program. All the stories of this divide between the big business interests and the Tea Party. And he basically called BS on it. He talks, he quotes a couple of these pieces. I don't know anybody in the business community who takes the side of the Taliban minority, says Dirk von Dalgen, chief lobbyist for the National Association of Wholesale Distributors in the Washington Post. So many in the House are hard right reactionary Tea Party, said Al Hoffman, a reliable GOP donor, in an interview with Politico. Those Republicans, it appears, are ready to self-immolate. Both Politico and Post have discovered business community wants to tame the Tea Party. But Weigel goes through all of the attempts by the so-called business community mad at the Tea Party in putting money where their mouths are in terms of challenging Tea Partiers. And he says they're outnumbered on the other side. Republican senators or Senate candidates in Alaska, Colorado, Iowa, Kentucky, South Carolina, and South Dakota are all fending off Tea Partiers. Just this week, Mississippi Senator Tad Cochran drew a challenger from his state Senate. Months ago, Karl Rove's founding of the Conservative Victory Project was teased on A1 of the New York Times as a force that could prevent future Todd Akins. It has raised no money, zero money, apart from another Rove-linked PAC to make it look like they have raised money. Could the ratio change if the establishment wanted it to, writes Weigel? Of course, but that's assuming big financial interests are naturally set against the Tea Party. They are not. They helped create the Tea Party. In the aggregate, if you leave aside the contractors who might benefit from our earmarks, they're better off when Tea Partiers run the House. Period. End of story. Everyone who is honest with themselves knows this is the case. Establishment Republicans may lament the fact that if they live in a red state, their girlfriends, wives, and daughters may have to go out of state to get an abortion. or that they may have to be just a little embarrassed when they're out with their friends who are gay, or their wives may be upset, or their mothers may be upset when they hear Todd Akin talk about real rape and non-real rape. But at the end of the day, they don't care. Weigel writes, the Tea Party, after all, is not wholly set against GOP's business class. It's just the latest populist movement funded and fueled by big business. And he makes the point that it was almost 100 years ago when one Texas businessman who backed the Liberty League said the capitalist system can be destroyed more effectively by having men of means defend it than by importing a million Reds from Moscow to attack it. In other words, you don't want the Koch brothers coming out there and defending the capitalist system. You want all the rubes they pay for in the AFP or the conservative movement for freedom and liberty and blah, blah, and the Tea Party. You want them ultimately to protect it. Even if they say they don't like these corporate big giveaways, because that's just, you know, page 47 on their talking point manual. Weigel writes, when you put aside the shutdown, the Tea Party members who now run the House are producing much more for the financial industry, for small business organizations, than Democrats would if they took the House back. No one's looking to primary the average class of the 2010 Republican because he's trying to repeal Dodd-Frank or challenge EPA rules or prevent any change in tax law that would anger the donors. That's the reality, folks. There is no daylight between the anti-government agenda that benefits big corporate interests and the anti of the Tea Party and the anti-government agenda of the establishment Republicans who want to benefit big business. There's simply no daylight there. It's a fiction to believe otherwise. And this so-called GOP civil war is more about personalities and a half a dozen races than anything else. The establishment Republicans just want the threat to be a little bit less toothless, or a little more toothless than it would be otherwise. But they love the idea that it leads into the rhetoric of cutting the EPA, that it brings them the sequester, on and on and on. And now they're just hoping, save those $20 billion in defense cuts, and we'll be square. You shall know these people by their checkbooks. And their checkbooks are not out. He writes, every successful movement of economic conservatives has been led in public by the non-rich, from the anti-tax farms of the 1920s to the property tax suburbanites in the 70s to the so-called family farmers who are, we are told, are the real victims of the estate tax. And you'll recall that not a single family farm was found when David K. Johnson famously asked all the agencies reporting on who's hit by the estate tax, can you name one family farm that went under because of the estate tax? None. So let that fiction die. All right, we got to take a break. We'll head into the better half of the program. There, one or two more facts. They got a breakdown of that, what is it, the Senate Conservative, whatever Jim DeMint's Heritage Action Fund is called, of what they spend their money on. Just how much they raised during the shutdown and what they spend their money on. And you will not be shocked. Al Franken told us this before, but now we see it in black and white. The right in this country, the conservative movement, is one big grift. It is one big scam to enrich not just these big business, but literally to enrich thousands upon thousands of people who belong to it. It is Conservative Inc. And that is why they are so relenting and supposedly don't care about their electoral fortunes. They don't have to. They're getting paid and they're winning. And you are losing. We'll also talk about these NSA stories and hear about Dick Cheney's And a new report about the deaths in Iraq brought to you by the U.S. tax dollars. All that and more in the better half. We'll take your phone call, 646-257-3920. We'll take your IMs. Folks, this month, this program is sponsored by Credo Mobile. Credo Mobile fuels Credo Action, which fights Tea Partiers and weak-kneed Democrats. They fight for progressive issues. They fund progressive nonprofits. They're the single largest donor to Planned Parenthood. And they are fully funded. 1% of their revenues, Credo Action, gets from CredoMobile.com. And you can get a deal that's good to the end of this month for Majority Report listeners. CredoMobile.com/Sam. You get up to $350 off of a switch fee credit. So if it costs you $350 or less to switch from whatever you got now to Credo, they'll give you a credit on your Credo bills. 25% discount on all data for the first 2 years, and that's unlimited data. Do it today. CredoMobile.com/Sam. This deal runs out October 31st. Do it now, folks. Also, if you want to support this program so that we can continue to give you 40 minutes free every day, and you want to, and or you want to get an extra 50 minutes a day, become a member today. 33 cents a day it costs you. 33 cents a day. We get 98% of our revenue from members. We got our Amazon link. You can buy your Amazon crap if you're so inclined. Do it through our link. We get a kickback. You can find it at the front page of majority.fm. You can do a one-off donation if you want. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Get a 10% discount. The coupon code majority. 646-257-3920 is the number, 646-257-3920. You can IM me at Majority FM. Remember, you want to listen on the go. The best way to listen to this program is our app. You can get it at majorityapp.com. See you on the flip side.